You are listening to Punk News Podcast number 226. Back to the Punk News Podcast. This is features editor John Gentile. We've got a, well, I don't want to say jam-packed episode tonight, but we got an episode tonight where we're going to dive into some stuff. We're going to be talking about Hot Water Music, the most orgiest of all orgcore bands. We're going to be talking about their new greatest hits compilation. We're going to be talking about Brian Wimpy Roy Goble passing away of DOA, which is sad. We're going to be talking about Off, one of the greatest modern punk rock bands, Keith Morris. He's a titan. He's a legend. He's a gladiator. Keith Morris is everything every punk rocker should strive to be. We're going to be talking about Dave Howes and Anti-Flag addressing social issues. We're going to be talking about Slater Kinney putting out the new tunes. And we're going to be talking about Fat Mike once again merging his three favorite things, punk rock, musicals, and S&M. So we're going to be talking about that. And here with me tonight, we've got two returning characters, two people that the Punk News Podcast listeners that email me and they say, John, when are my two favorite podcasters going to be on? And I say, who? And they say, first of all, they say, John, we got to have him on. We got to have the guy that brings the most, the most insight, the most life experience. He's a man of culture. He's a man of education. He's a man of business. We are here with managing editor Adam White. Adam White, are you excited for tonight's podcast? Woo!
I'm excited for tonight's podcast. I don't think anyone is excited that I am on this podcast.
No, they are, Adam, and here's why. You know, Adam White, he's a mysterious figure to me. You know, he's very he's very, very intelligent. He's very, very well-spoken. He's very, very thoughtful, and plus he's business savvy. And I would say he has a heart. But what's interesting is Adam White, you know, he's crossed the 30 mark, so he's an adult. But he just got his first tattoo ever. Past the age of 30. Adam White, what is your tattoo, and what prompted this radical life decision?
All right. So, yeah, I have my first tattoo. Do you want to do the story now, or do you want to introduce the other person, and then we can do the story?
Well, okay, we're also here with Mark Little,
yeah.
who has many tattoos. Briefly, Mark Little, what was the first tattoo that you ever got?
The first tattoo I ever got was – hi, everybody, by the way. The first tattoo I ever got was a necklace charm that I used to have. My neck got too big for the necklace, and it was a thing that I received from a family that I lived with, and I lived in Bogota, Colombia. So it was a small little like $50 charm that I got on my ankle that I still have today that I've never covered up.
And what is the worst tattoo that you have? Is it your what were the two Olympian guys? I can't remember. I'm blowing this. The two guys from like the 92 Olympics that like everyone thought were, like would like be the best guys, and they were both terrible. Damn it!
Wait, I don't have
tattoo. That's incredibly esoteric.
I don't have a tattoo of either of those guys.
Do you have a "Where's the Beef" tattooed on your back?
I don't, but I do have a tramp stamp on my back. I have to admit, I do. I have a symbol for strength underneath. I had back surgery about 10 years ago, and I have a symbol for strength in Japanese right underneath it. And it's absolutely the biggest regret that I ever have, and I want to get a big back piece so I can cover that up.
What back piece might you get? Maybe a mural of those two 1992 Olympians.
That would be great. Oh, God, that would be fantastic. If you guys could find out who they are and sketch that out for me, I think I'll go get that done with Adam.
Adam,
you need to give them a little bit more detail then. You know those two Olympians that John was trying to make a joke about but couldn't quite even figure out why he was trying to make the joke?
I burned horribly on that joke. I'm going to figure these – like there was all these commercials with them. Like, I'm going to do better.
Was it Dan and Dave? Something like that.
Yeah. I think that's it. Let me look this up. But Adam White, tell us. Why? Yeah, Dan and Dave. Here we go. Dan and Dave was an advertising and merchandising. Wait, maybe they weren't even real Olympians.
No, they were, but they were supposed to win whatever their respective events were. I think they were decathletes or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. Dan O'Brien and Dave Johnson.
And one of them got injured. Another one just flailed or something like that. And I think neither of them medaled.
O'Brien failed to qualify for the Olympics. So there you go. Don't base your marketing campaign around two could be Olympians. But Adam White, did you get an Olympian? Did you get Sean White on your shoulder, or Dan Phelps, or what did you get on your shoulder?
No, we only do Canadian Olympians, so I've got like a big tattoo of Ross Rebliati, the snowboarder from a couple of Olympics ago. I don't know, smoking a huge doob because that was what he got really famous for in Canada. Aside from winning, was drugs. So I got a half sleeve done on my left arm, shoulder and arm, I guess, there's a Canadian folk legend called the Chasse Galerie, which I guess if you're going to translate that, it's the hunting party. And it's kind of a Canadian Quebecois version of a folktale that exists in Europe called the Wild Hunt. Basically, long story, I'm just going to tell a story because... I don't know. What else do we have to do tonight? So anyways, the whole key piece of visual in this is that there's a flying canoe. And this is a voyageur birch bark canoe full of, like, dudes in toques. And basically, there's a bunch of guys. They're in northern Quebec. We're coming up to Christmas or New Year's. They want to go down to civilization out of the logging camp that they're in to go see their families and to party. But they can't because they're in northern Quebec and we're, 150 years ago. So how do they get down there? They make a deal with the devil. The devil says, hey, I'll let you get in your canoe and fucking fly down there in your canoe, but I'm going to have some conditions. You guys can't run into church steeples. You can't, get really drunk and start blaspheming in there. Because if you do any of that shit, I'm either going to dump the canoe or take your souls or, whatever version of this you want. So they go down to this party and they yuck it up. And one of them gets super drunk at the party. But then they got to be back in this canoe and back up north by midnight. So they go and they get back in their flying canoe. And they're flying. And the one guy is just swearing his head off and dropping his tabernacles and all of his French, horrible blasphemes as much as he can. And they got to tie this guy up and try to make sure that he doesn't fuck their shit up. And then depending on which version of the legend you... are hearing different horrible things or not so horrible things happen to them. And I told that in like the least folklore-y way possible, but it's basically a big piece of Canadian folklore on my shoulder. And it's kind of like it's the moon, and in front of the moon is the flying canoe full of these woodsmen, and there's like wintry trees and shit like that around it. That's what I got.
Why is that story meaningful for you, Adam White?
On the one hand, it's an incredibly obscure way of me getting a big douchebaggy Canadian flag tattoo. But
like the guys in North Jersey that get like the Italian flag like on their shoulder or something,
Yeah, but instead of getting the Italian flag on their shoulder, if they got like the Cavs, Romulus and Remus or something like that, right?
Or what's his name? I'm blowing all my references tonight. The clown. What the hell's his name? Pagliacci.
Yeah, right. So it's got that call. It's got that. Sure, that wasn't it, but whatever. It's got that cultural connection, but it's not actually that. I just always like that story. I heard that story first when I was like a young kid being raised as like a Catholic. So the religiousness of it kind of stuck with me. But then when I started listening to a lot of bad religion and being a horrible person and got away from all that, I don't know. I find a lot of symbolism in it. And depending on which way I'm thinking about it, I'm either the guy in the canoe or I'm the devil, or I don't know. I factor into that story in a lot of ways. I like it.
It's kind of like the end of Pulp Fiction where he's like, am I the gun, I enjoyed it. I guess last question about this, but Adam, I find it particularly interesting that the devil doesn't want them to act badly. So the devil's acting as a positive force. He's saying you must act well, or I will punish you for acting bad. Very interesting.
Well, the devil's basically screwing them because the devil's saying, like, all right, you guys go party. I'm going to give you this list of things you can't possibly live up to, and then when you fuck it up, I'm going to take your stuff. So by even agreeing to this deal in the first place, you guys are dumb. But hey.
So he's a predatory lender, I think.
I think there's a little bit of that. Well, and he's a little bit of the trickster devil in this case, where he's, he's giving them, he's not just screwing with them, he's giving them a way to get out of it if they don't screw up.
That might be my favorite version of the devil, the trickster devil. Adam White, last question. Most people get their first tattoo when they're 17, 18. Why post-30? What prompted this radical alteration to your body?
I'm a horrible coward, and... No, that's not really a reason. I would have done this a long time ago. I just didn't have anything exactly that I had thought about to the point that I really wanted it. Although that's really funny because, like they say, you get your first one of these and you immediately know what you want for the next one. And yeah, I do. But
And that's exactly what I was going to ask you about.
Yeah, well, we'll get to that. I don't know why I waited this long. I kind of figured that, like, I'm at this point in my life where I'm 32, 33? I don't even know how old I am. I'm 32. I have, like a job that's incredibly stable and soon to be two kids, and, like, I'm married, and, like, there is so much stability in my life that there is no possible way that doing this has any repercussions. I'm only going to become uglier and more horrible from this point on. So it's not like even people are going to be like, oh, you were such a beautiful young man and then you got covered in those tattoos. It's like, no, I wasn't. I was basically at the point where you only get grosser. So at this point, it doesn't matter what I do. That's what I've decided.
Well, there you have it. Adam White has, once again, using his analytical mind, found the exact perfect time to get a tattoo. The point where you stop getting better looking and start getting uglier, that's the point to get a tattoo. Speaking of people that have tattoos, let's talk about Hot Water Music. Hot Water Music is putting out a 20th anniversary retrospective. It's basically a greatest hits album, but it's going to have some 7-inch records on it. It's due out March 24, 2015. I don't think they've released a track listing yet.
Yeah, they have you dig through to the merch site.
Oh, they have. Okay, let's take a brief look at the track listing. I'm looking at the $60 version of the record, and hopefully there's a cheaper version.
Yeah, it's there, it's there.
H. That's 8 sides. And so they've got lots of tracks, stuff from every album, and plus some what they call missing pieces, so some rare stuff, such as Alachua, Moon Pies, Last Goodbyes, Us and Chuck, and some other rarities. A, are you guys excited for this? B, does Hot Water Music even need Greatest Hits? C, is Greatest Hits, does that even serve a function for any band? Nevertheless, Hot Water Music.
Well, I think for Hot Water Music, if you're a fan of Hot Water Music, and I think pretty much anybody that listens to this podcast is a Hot Water Music fan, like you just said, they are the orgiest of orgcore bands. Having Greatest Hits, is it really necessary? I think all of us that are fans probably have all of this stuff. But if you're a collector nerd, as many of us are, then a lot of people are going to be picking this up. I mean, if you've got nothing but vinyl pieces, for example, people are going to be all into this. Myself, I love Hot Water Music. I've probably got all of this stuff. Unless there's something that's really, really going to be extra collectory for me, I doubt I'll be picking it personally. But hey, Hot Water Music, I'm always into seeing them in the news.
People will buy this because Hot Water Music fans are of that kind of like crazy vinyl collector nerd that they will go and chase, you know, every upteen version of something that's released more than maybe a fan of another band would. And which is not a judgment or anything like that. It's just that just always how it seemed to me. So there's definitely an audience for something like this. But as Mark said, and anyone that's into this band has all of these songs, has heard all of these songs, has some way of consuming all of these songs. And that one of our commenters kind of had it right, I think, where I would much rather get like a vinyl box set of the actual albums, you know, in their entireties than this where it's stuff cut from them. So I don't know. To me, it's a little bit of a Clash on Broadway move here. Like it's taking a bunch of good albums that you should hear in their entirety and then culling a bunch of good stuff from them and putting it all together. And if that's your introduction to this band, then, you know, that's probably great. I don't know exactly what the value would be if you're already into them.
Well, and Greatest Hits Records, I'm sorry to interrupt you, John, but like you just said, Adam, right there, that's the perfect way to say it. Greatest Hits Records really are the way to introduce new fans to an older band. And for something like that, that would be great. But this also looks like something much bigger than your average Greatest Hits collection, to be fair.
This should be a gift for your, like, 17-year-old, you know, nephew who is into horrible music but has potential.
That's quite a
nice one. Merry Christmas.
Like, Billy, come here. Like, I see you got a record player and you got a little milk crate there full of records, but it's all falling in reverse and no one likes you and you're a douchebag. but I'm gonna splurge. And I'm gonna get you this cool colored vinyl collectible. It ticks all the, you know, materialist boxes that you've got. You want this. It's awesome, but it'll fix you. And that's what you give it to him.
There you go.
You know, I don't know if greatest hits really work for punk bands, to tell you the truth, because generally punk bands put out albums, not just collection of singles. There's a lot of classic rock bands that I've got their greatest hits, and then I thoroughly, you know, like Tom Petty's greatest hits is really good. Because, you know, does Tom Petty really do albums, or does he do songs? You know what I mean?
And I'll then, get letters from the Tom Petty people.
Yeah, John, how dare you talk about Tom Petty that way, you know? I don't know if this – I mean, because it's so – it's $60 for the vinyl version plus shipping. So any – like, this is not an introductory item, say, hey, here's how you check out this band for the first time ever. So it's really for only for people that are, like, really into the band, and it's stuff they already have. So I feel it's kind of not well. Well, it's well thought out that it'll sell because collectors want it, like Adam says. But it's not really going to introduce that many people to that much music. But that being said, what can you do? But I do have to defend Clash on Broadway, because even though Clash on Broadway did have mostly, you know, just studio tracks, there were about 10 or 12 sweet, sweet rarities down in those grooves.
Oh yeah, I mean the was that ever a vinyl thing down in those grooves?
Clash
on Broadway ever on vinyl?
No, just CD.
All right. Let's be clear here. Anyways, though, yeah, I love Clash on Broadway. God, we could do like a whole podcast about Clash on Broadway.
Yeah, you know, I actually believe it. I'm going to sound like such a douchebag when I say this, as opposed to the other times when I'm talking.
Yeah.
But my favorite version between the UK and the US version of the Clash first record is the Clash on Broadway version, which is all the tracks put together except for, I think, Career Opportunities or something. Complete control, because it's like all their song, all the singles, all put together, and I love it. Anyways, let's talk about something sad, then we'll get back to happy again.
Like Protex Blue. Let's talk about Protex Blue for a while.
Protex Blue. Brian, this is a horrible way to leave to in memorial.
Oh God! All
pause.
Right, yeah.
Pause. We're getting serious here. I'm really not trying to make fun of this. Some sad news. Brian Wimpy Roy Goble passed away just this week. Wimpy Roy was an extremely famous, well, I don't know what famous, in the punk rock scene, extremely well-known guitarist, bassist, and singer. He was in the Skulls, which is credited as, I think, Toronto's second ever punk rock band, and maybe even Canada's second ever punk rock band. He was in the Subhumans EU, Canada, and he was also in DOA after he left the Subhumans. He's on some of the most important, I would say, the most important Canadian punk rock songs of all time, a lot of them. He passed away from a heart attack. I think down in the States, people really aren't as hip to DOA and the Subhumans as they are up in Canada. And it's kind of a shame because it's some great, great music. So, I mean, what else can you say? The guy passed away suddenly and it's sad, you know? So I would say check out the Subhumans. The problem with Subhumans is their stuff is extremely rare. So rare, in fact, that they actually had to re-record their first album for Alternative Tentacles, because I think the actual owner of their album is CD Presents, or if it's not CD Presents, it's one of those other, like, really sketchy punk rock labels that, like, holds on to stuff and never, ever lets it go, but doesn't repress it either. So it's hard to find Subhuman stuff. But Wimpy Roy's DOA stuff is easy to find. Skulls, I do not believe there's any official live recordings at all. But, I mean, it's some great music.
Yeah, this is sad. I mean, like, it's – he was involved in so many of those bands that were just the kind of like the foundation in the late 70s and early 80s of what became the Canadian punk scene, at least as far as Canadian punk bands from that time that made any kind of waves – outside of Canada, he was involved in each and every one of them, basically. I mean, you know, if you were down in California in the, you know, in the late 70s, early 80s, the bands that you were going to hear about out of Canada would have been Subhumans and DOA. And those are both ones that he was involved in. I mean, primarily Subhumans there. But Yeah, I don't really know what to say too much. It's sad when we lose any one of these guys. We're just in that phase where we're losing a lot of the people that were there at the start, that were the foundational people.
Yeah, and it's going to keep up because, you know, these guys are hitting 60, 70 years old. So, unfortunately, it's a fact of life, you know?
Yeah, that's what's happening. I don't know what to go with on this. It's happened. We've been hearing a lot. It's been nice to actually see a lot of the reaction out of some of the guys that are, you know, involved in music today that have come out about this. And I mean, like, that, I always love hearing from Jesse Luscious of Alternative Tentacles. So he chimed in when we posted this, where, you know, there's not a lot of people on punk news in 2014 necessarily that are talking about Wimpy Roy. But, you know, you get a lot of the people that run the labels that you know, release the music we talk about, and they're aware of this guy, and they're aware of the stuff that he was doing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, anyway, over to happier news, another guy that was there at the start, Keith Morris, the living legend, the champion, perhaps the greatest punk rock frontman of all time. His band, Off, as I'm sure you all know, they released a new video. The video is for the song Over Our Heads. It's off their last album, Wasted Years, from early this year. In the video has Jack Black, and you gotta watch the video on Punk News. It's hilarious. I'll just briefly summarize the beginning. In the beginning, the guys in Off are in a airplane, and they're gonna parachute jump. Is that skydive? They're gonna skydive for Keith Morris's birthday. But Jeff McDonald, or is it Stephen Shane McDonald, drops acid before they jump. And so he jumps out and gets, like, cut up in the propeller, and then the plane starts to crash. So Jack Black, who's, like, the instructor, is, like, throwing them out the plane. He's like, we got to get to safety. And, what did you guys think of this video? Let me prompt us. I love this video. I thought it was hilarious. But I found myself not listening to the music at all. I was strictly watching the video, you know?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, I remember after I saw the video, somebody made the comment that Dimitri is a great, phenomenal actor. And for these kinds of things, the videos that Off does, and Off has done a lot of great videos during the 3 or 4 years they've been doing these things with Jack Black. Dimitri really does play off the deadpan comedy thing so well. And he has absolutely the greatest line.
Yes. Ever. Yes.
Where he talks about, and I don't know if you want to say it for me, John.
No, you go ahead and say it, Mark. This is one of my favorite. This is my favorite zinger all year.
Keith, I'm just not some dick in a Circle Jerks cover band. Which, I mean, knowing the history of Off and knowing the story behind, you know, when they first started the band and everything like that, to see them recognize the humor behind the story and what people say about them behind their origins was phenomenal. And I just love seeing that. I love seeing a bunch of guys that are able to poke fun at themselves. And it's just one of the many reasons why I love that band.
This video was super funny. I don't know. Yeah. I wasn't really listening too much to the music because there was lots of hilarious things happening. Although it was one of those moments where I thought they were just going to do a bunch of comedy, but then when he gets sucked into the propeller, you're just like, holy shit. And then the music kicks in. And that's what made it great. That whole thing. And then the end, which I don't know if are we spoiling the end of this video or should people go watch it?
Because there's a sequel that's coming out tomorrow. There's a second half to this video.
All right. Let's not spoil the end of the video because it's wonderful. But people should go watch it to the end because there's more hilarity that comes in. And, how do they get Jack Black? I mean, I guess Jack Black is hip to what's, you know, who Keith Morris is and stuff like that. But it's
good question.
That's a surprisingly like high bankroll that you're spending on talent in that case.
Well, he's also clearly a fan.
Yeah, he's been in some of their other videos. Good question. My guess is the following: Jack Black is about 40, right? So he definitely could be a punk rock fan, especially like the earliest stuff. You know, I think he's like 40, 1969. So what's that? That's so he's 45.
44, 45.
Yeah, so he definitely could be like an OG punk rocker. And also,
speaking of which, we'll come back to that. Keep talking about Jack Black. We're going to talk about this in a second.
But also it's on Vice, and you know Vice has got some of those hipper connections. And so I bet Jack Black's just working for scale on this. I don't think he's making too. I don't think there's a whole lot of money to dish out for Off. There's probably a little bit of money, but not tons of money. You know, but I guess the other thing is I love this video because it's kind of like an 80s video, like a BC Boys video from back in the day, or you know where the music is, well, the music's not that prominent. I kind of wish the music was more prominent. But where the band isn't, like, saying, here's our grand, overproduced, you know, far out there video. It's just the band having fun and being funny and telling sort of a story in the video. So I loved it. I love 80s music videos that are like that, and that's kind of what this is. And I think it perfectly fits the music.
Yeah, it absolutely had that Beastie Boys vibe to what was going on. But no, what I was going to mention when you were talking about Jack Black's age and that he was probably hip to this music, I don't know if this was common knowledge, but it wasn't knowledge to me. But I was listening to NPR the other day, and they were interviewing Josh Brolin.
Mm.
And he used to be in RKL.
Really?
Yeah.
Get out of here.
Yeah, we see he said when RKL was just playing in a garage and before they had done any, they had recorded anything, before they'd really done anything, when it was just basically just a bunch of kids, he had like big fucking, a big bleached mohawk, and I don't know if he said he drummed or what he did, but he was in RKL for at least some period.
That's crazy.
That I thought, I assume I'm like, oh shit, does everyone know this? But I don't know this, but it was super funny to me. So yeah, there you go.
Well I liked it. Never mind. There was also a Jack Black in the band called The Boys from the UK that some people might know, but it's not that Jack Black. It's a different Jack Black.
He's not British enough.
Yeah, yeah. Let's play a tune, because I don't know how we can follow up Jack Black watching people get cut up in Propellers, and the shocking realization that Josh Brolin used to be in RKL, which is insane.
My jaws dropped.
So let's play two.
Here's what you need to do, Punk News Podcast listeners. Find a photo, because I could not. This was back before there were cameras in the 70s.
Everywhere.
Whatever. So, before there were cameras everywhere. So anyways, someone should try to get that, because I would love to see a photo of this.
Well, let's play a tune. Who's got a tune? Adam White, you got a tune?
Yeah. All right. I'm gonna play something here. So first of all, you guys can help me settle a debate, because I'm gonna play a song from a band called Teenager. Now, Teenager is from Toronto. They had a really cool release that came out this year on the what's the name of the label here? Was it Television Explosion? I think it was Television Explosion. We're going to say Television Explosion until I can see otherwise. Telephone Explosion. Shit, that's the name of the label. Anyways, yeah. So this album that they had come out, or this release that they had come out, is titled EPLP. And EPLP is 8 songs, and it's around 22 minutes. So since we're coming up on end of year list time, and it's the time when I really have to care about whether something is an EP or an LP. Well, what is this, John?
Well, first of all, it's a ripoff of the Subhumans, who have the EPLP. And that's a collection of their EPs, though. But I got to say, let's dig into this. How do you determine if a record is an EP or an LP? Here's John's answer. First, you have to look at the band's intention. Did they intend it to be an EP, or did they intend it to be an LP? That is influential, but it is not just positive, because some bands will put out a 7-inch and say it's an album. There is no way a 7-inch record can be an album. I don't care how many songs are on it. Second, we see how long is it? You know, is it over 25 minutes? Is it under 25 minutes? Under 25 minutes, probably an EP. Over 25 minutes, probably an LP. Third thing we look at, how many songs are on it? If it's less than 3 songs, it's probably a single, unless the 2 songs are extraordinarily long. If it's less than 9 songs, it's probably an EP, unless it's over 25 minutes. In this case, because it's less than 9 songs, and because it's less than 25 minutes, and because the band has not been clearly dispositive on what they think of it as, I say EP.
See, I would say EP, except the fact that they have called it an EPLP to me says that this is our big release for 2014. Like, this is the main show that you're going to get from us. So this isn't a teaser. This isn't something that's midway before the real LP comes out. This is the thing.
See, but I think they're saying it's the EP that will act as a definitive statement, you see.
Yeah, yes, it's difficult. So anyways, we're going to play a song from this sucker. The song I'm going to play is called Sky Saxon. Now, what's Sky Saxon, John?
Sky Saxon is it in a band, right?
Yes. Sky Saxon was the lead singer and band leader of L.A. psychedelic garage band The Seeds.
That's right. That's right.
So this song is named after Sky Saxon. If you've ever heard Teenager, they do all kinds of like fun garagey rock, psychedelic rock kind of stuff. Some of it female vocals, some of it male vocals, all of it fun. So anyways, this song is called Sky Saxon. It is from the EP LP by Toronto punk rockers Teenager from their album or their release on Telephone Explosion Records. So here you go. Talk about more stuff. So then we're back to talk about difficult things, I believe. Are we not, John?
Yeah, we are. We are. Should we crack jokes beforehand like we always do on sad articles?
I don't know. So
we always roll in the sad articles with like jokes.
Yeah, so all right. We got two of these that we're going to go into, and they share a theme, and I don't know. I won't commentate. I'll just get into the first one here. So the first one, and every time I say this guy's name, I say it the wrong way.
House.
Be like a dick. Is it House or is it Haas?
Oh,
Haas.
I don't even know.
Rhymes with pause.
Yeah, and everyone tells me, and he's even said it, and then I always end up mixing him up and thinking like, no, that's the one he doesn't want. So anyways, Dave Haas, rhymes with
there
pause.
There you go.
Has written and posted a song called Season's Greetings from Ferguson. Now, I feel that we, like, joked it up before we started this article, and it's supposed to be a serious one. Anyways, he writes, "Hello, friends. With recent events in Ferguson weighing heavily on us all, I wrote this song. With the announcement in NYC, these themes are sadly just as relevant as they were last week or any day in America. Take care out there." And you can find the link to the song, it's hosted on YouTube right now, that Dave Haas put together called Season's Greetings from Ferguson. So that's story number one. You want me to get into story number two?
Yeah, let's roll them together.
So story number two, And this all plays off the fact that that America has had a troubling couple of weeks here. So Anti-Flag has weighed in on the controversial grand jury decision, which saw no charges laid against police when Eric Garner died after being arrested in Staten Island. No, they said this. Anti-Flag said, another abuse of power and murder by the police and another grand jury that fails to deliver an indictment. Police violence against Black Americans like Michael Brown, Tamir Rice, Oscar Grant, and Eric Garner is not the exception, and it is not happening in a vacuum. It's happening because of an unjust legal system that gives police a license to murder and protects them when they do. Anti-Flag stands in solidarity with those in the streets and all of those calling for change to an unjust, racist legal system. And this was just after the Eric Garner decision came down. So there were protests in New York City at the time, around when we posted that article. So those two stories, two different punk bands reacting to two different but, incredibly, I guess, thematically linked happenings in the U.S. justice system with regards to police not being indicted after unarmed Black men died in, I don't know, confrontations with them, I guess.
I would say suspicious circumstances.
Suspicious circumstances. So anyways, how do we approach this? Because I don't know if it's necessarily useful for society for us to get into the problems or perceived problems with the U.S. grand jury system and everything on here. Do you want to talk maybe a bit about how bands react to this stuff?
Yeah, let's talk about that. I'll kick it off. Basically, the idea of these kinds of songs or these kinds of statements goes all the way back to, music itself. Medieval music before then, actually ancient music. If you look at lyrics from ancient songs, you have the, I refer to the admonitions of Ipuwer from ancient Egypt. You have musicians basically commenting on the woes of the day and why things are wrong and why they should be corrected. The question is, for something like this, how beneficial is it really? Does it really change people's attitudes? The answer is, I think it does if it's a well-known artist like Bruce Springsteen or Bob Dylan or Taylor Swift or Beyonce. I think that would change people's minds as a whole. With artists like Anti-Flag or Dave Howes, not that they shouldn't, write these kinds of songs or statements, but I think they're essentially preaching to the choir, and that's not their fault, it's just how things wound up in their career. I don't know if that has any real effect. One time I had somebody, in a related story, someone said to me that you should not attack or comment or address specific guys that are blatantly racist, because that detracts from the institutional racism that we should really be focusing on. And I thought that was the most ridiculous thing I ever heard. And so I sort of saw this argument here, in that people were saying, well, Dave Howes or Anti-Flag shouldn't comment on this because it encourages slacktivism. That is, simply by listening to this kind of song, you feel as though you're doing something when you're really not. But I think it's a necessary... So, have I been clear with regards to that? Like, the anti-argument to this is that if Dave Howes writes a song like this and preaches to the choir, people are like, yes, Dave Howes is right. This is an injustice. And those people feel validated in that they've actually done something when they really have not. That's the argument against it. But I would say a song like this is, I don't want to say it's a necessary evil, but it's a function that has elements that don't perform as you want them to, but it has positive benefits to it too. And by that I'm saying, perhaps this kind of encourages slacktivism, this kind of song, be it from Dave Hawes, or Bruce Springsteen. And people say, oh, he's so right. It's such a tragedy. But for the few people that it actually does call to action, those actions have profound effects. So even though the majority of the people might not actually do anything because of this song, the few people that do have a much greater effect than one would expect.
I wonder sometimes about whether bands feel a little bit painted into the corner where they have to make statements about things like this. I'm really thinking about Anti-Flag here. I mean, Dave Haas has written political songs before, but he by no means is a protest singer. So he doesn't need to respond to something like this. And I guess for better or worse, I see a song from Dave Haas come out about here, and I feel it feels more genuine to me than if, say, like Anti-Flag put out a song about it. Only because it's not necessarily something that you would expect him to do, so therefore it carries more weight. Anti-Flag, I feel sometimes like they have to comment on this stuff because their entire repertoire is addressing things of this nature, and as they keep coming up, you know, whether the band even, I think, whether let's say take politics out of it, whether the band, say, feels that they creatively need to make a statement or not, I feel that Anti-Flag sometimes just has to make a statement because they're Anti-Flag. Like, this is their shit, right? Like, this is the kind of thing that they talk about. And I wonder sometimes, just on a personal level, if you know, these things come up and let's say you're just insane and you say that you see these stories come up. If you look at them and go like, man, I can't just process and try to deal with this shit like a human being would. I have to go get on the internet because people want to know what I think about it. I wonder if that's limiting.
Mark, did you have something to add?
Well, there's not a whole lot I can add behind what the two of you guys are saying. I really agree. I mean, I'm sitting here nodding my head a lot when Adam is speaking, because on one end, when he's talking about how when Anti-Flag says something, I mean, of course, when something like this happens, you would expect Anti-Flag to come out with some kind of statement, and, you know, good on them as well. But I have to say, and also as a fan of Dave Haas, much more than I am of Anti-Flag, I was somewhat surprised to see him come out with something very quickly, because I never would have expected an artist like him to come out with a song relating to a political event happening in the last week, the last 2 weeks. And I'm not saying that I don't expect an artist to come out speaking about recent political events, because you think about the 60s, you think about protest music and things. But to see him come out very, very quickly and just have this, I had this on my mind, I wanted to put this out, it just seemed very genuine to me. And I don't think that I never got the impression that he thought that it was going to affect some kind of change so much as it was, this is on my mind, I want to put this out, and I just, as an artist, I wanted to express this.
You know, I'm going to play the part of Adam's tattoo and be the devil's advocate here. And I refer to Anti-Flag. You know, what always struck a chord with me was Penny Rimbaud of Crass. A lot of people know that Crass was the first punk rock band to put, like, dead bodies on their album cover, like, at least the first punk band, to put, like, dead bodies on their album covers. And the idea was to say, look at the atrocities of war. Look at what your government is doing to people. But then Penny Rimbaud, about, you know, after Crass had long since ended, I mean, now, a few years ago, he's like, they've taken that aesthetic, you know, anarcho-punk bands have taken that aesthetic and made it into a sort of pornography, in that now they don't use the image to, like, shock people or even inform people. They're using that image to brand themselves as a, quote, anarcho-punk band. And so I wonder, like, is Anti-Flag maybe by their doing, maybe not by their not their, maybe by their own doing, maybe not by their own doing, are they making pornography out of current events? You know, like, as sort of like Adam was saying, is now, like, something happens in the news, Anti-Flag uses that to carry on the Anti-Flag brand, or the, and I don't mean brand in the marketing sense, I mean the Anti-Flag identity. So not that they have an underlying, or not that they want to have an underlying comment about it, but because it's their function to use this as a platform to speak, as opposed to really, I guess, having their heart in the right place. I don't know if that's the case, but I wonder if that does get mixed up in it. You see what I'm saying?
I think that's a great point. I think it goes back to I think what all of us are basically saying, where it's that Anti-Flag feels that, right or wrong, that it's their obligation to have an opinion when something like this comes out. They've got to make a statement that is part of their, like you said, part of their aesthetic. That's part of their, part of what they are.
But at what point does them having to make a statement cross over from them commenting because they feel they need to comment to them commenting because they know to maintain their brand they have to comment? Let's leave that one out to the Punk News listeners. Reach us at podcast@punknews.org, and you can weigh in on this deep philosophical conversation.
No, I think it's a great question also, because, and I, I mean, in a way, it invites the question of how genuine are they with bringing in. I don't want to say they're being disingenuous, but the fact that they have to feel that they have to comment on something as opposed to what their real opinions might be.
Right.
At that moment, if you know what I'm saying. I don't want to say they're being disingenuous, but at the same time, it brings up what you're saying about how far is what they're saying is bringing about is progressing the Annie Flagg brand, so to speak.
Yeah, I don't think they're diabolically, like, you know, twiddling their fingers and like, we'll make money off this guy's death.
Precisely.
So, but reach us with your opinions. podcast@punknews.org. Let's keep this rocking back to happier stuff. I know this is going to make Adam White happy. Sleater-Kinney, not only are they back together, not only are they putting out a new album, they put out a brand new single. The single is called Surface Envy. The new album is out January 20th, 2015, back on Sub Pop Records. And Adam White, I know you're a Sleater-Kinney fan. Did you dig the tune? Did you dig the track?
I do. I did. I don't know. I'm going to just keep spouting out things that have pronouns in it. Anyways, yeah, I'm super into this. I really like this song. I think it's super fun. I think there's wacky guitar stuff that happens in it that is very fun. I cannot wait for this record to come out. I really like the sound of this. As much as I was a fan of The Woods, which was their last full length in 2005? Where did I say 2005?
2006, yeah.
Yeah, so as much as I was a fan of The Woods, because it was just fucking crazy and loud and distorted and like the most like rock and roll rock record you could imagine, it did have some kind of wacky production on it where it was so loud and so in your face that it was kind of headache inducing at times. And this just sounds really nice and crisp and more like One Beat and stuff like that. So anyways, yeah, so I'm into this. I can't wait for this to come out. Adam is excited.
I'm with Adam. I am so into this song, I can't even tell you. And one of my friends, my buddy Potter, that I was buddies with in college, he lives up in Philadelphia. He's going to go see Sleater-Kinney when they're playing, I think, at Union Transfer in February. And I am so jealous. I just checked on their website earlier today, and that show is sold out, and I would love to go up there and go see them. This song is so good, and I can't wait to hear this record when it comes out in January.
Well, there you go. A lot of people waiting in anticipation. And speaking of a guy that's a master of anticipation, Fat Mike, he's crossed over. He's putting out a musical. It's going to be a punk rock musical, and it's going to be called Home Street Home. The album of it is due out February 10, 2015. Fat Mike, or Mike Burkett, co-wrote the lyrics with Jeff Marks and Soma Snake Oil. That's his girlfriend, right? Soma Snake Oil?
Yeah.
And then on it is going to be Fat Mike of NOFX. And there's also going to be Frank Turner, Alkaline Trios, Matt Skiba, and Lena Hall from Hedwig and the Angry Itch. Bad Cop, Stacey D is going to be on it. Tony Sly is on it. Presumably, he recorded his contribution before he passed away. The Dancehall Crashers, Karina Deneke is going to be on it. And there's also going to be members of the Descendants, Lagwag, and Old Man Malarkey, Mad Caddies, Me First, the Agrolites, the Living End, the Real McKenzie, and RKL. Are you guys excited for this?
Hey, maybe Josh Brolin's going to be on
it. Maybe Josh Brolin will be on it. Who knows? I'll kick us off. I got to say, I'm not the world's biggest NOFX fan. I'm not necessarily anti-NOFX. But I feel as though Mike doesn't get enough credit for being artistically daring. People think of him kind of like as, you know, I don't know, I guess entry-level punk rock or jokester punk rock. But they've done some pretty out there stuff. I think of The Decline, which was pretty radical. They weren't the first punk rock band to put out like a 20-minute track. But before them, who had done it? Just Crass, I believe. I'm trying to think. Oh, and the Subhumans, Cradle to the Grave. You know, they recorded an EP in 2 days for fun. They did a secret covers EP. They did the high concept stuff with Cokie the Clown, where Mike developed an alter ego that was like depressed. But he was like a clown, and you know, they did the whole gag by pissing in people's drinks, which wasn't real. I wonder if Mike doesn't get enough credit for being artistically daring. And the second question is this artistically daring, or is this just following in somebody else's shoes? And we all know who that somebody else is.
We won't mention him.
Say it.
So you know the funny thing was is that I read the listing of people involved in this, and my immediate reaction was, of course Skiba's involved. I don't know why. That was my for some reason when like, I don't know, To me, Matt Skiba is the kind of person that would, of course, be involved in someone's musical project. I don't know what that means about me that I think that. But anyway.
Was there anybody that surprised you when you looked at it?
No, it's people that Mike knows and hangs out with. I mean, the fact that it's a lot of fat bands that are roped into that, you know, and a few non-fat bands, I guess, like the Agra Lights and Living End. But, you know, it's a bunch of guys that Mike knows and hangs out with and likes and stuff like that. Not knowing anything about this or knowing any of the music on it, I'm sure this will be infinitely more interesting than the other musical punk stuff that we've heard from the person who shall remain nameless. Only because I have far more faith in Mike that he's not going to make something boring, I guess. Not even boring, because NoFX can be boring. What am I trying to say?
Overwrought.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's not going to be epic for the sake of being epic. Like, and I guess that's really my main problem with the stuff I'm really trying not to name. I don't even know why. Because it's overwrought's the right word for it. It feigns importance. It says not only am I a bunch of music that is sequentially held together by a storyline, which is fine, you can do that. Fucked Up does that, whatever. It's music that is done in a way that is also embracing the operatic part of it, where it's saying, look how friggin' important this is because it is an artistic statement. And I don't think that Mike is the kind of person that would do that.
Is Mike giving the middle finger to He Who Shall Not Be Named by doing, I would say, probably a spunkier, wackier musical? Is he saying, this is how you're supposed to do it?
I think Mike would have had him on there if he could have.
Yeah, I don't think that guy gets to own that genre. I just think that he's done an incredibly public and bad version of it. So, yeah, I don't know. I can't even keep dancing around. Like, I don't know if people in the punk scene, at least people in, like, Mike's realm of the punk scene, actually have any kind of, like, you know, ill will against what Billy Joe Armstrong was doing with those Green Day records when they came out. But they, you know, I'm sure they're not fans necessarily of some of the more overwrought stuff on there, but I doubt they're, like, I don't know, wringing their hands about it or anything like that. I just, you know.
True, but I would wager, I mean, you know, a lot of that, you know, all that whole crew, you know, everybody from Rancid to NoFX, that whole crew comes from kind of a similar scene, you know, and so I think a lot of them, I certainly don't know, but I would wager a lot of them have a certain sort of, I guess, aggression towards that guy that we shall not, do we name him yet?
I just named him.
Oh, towards Billy Joe, because Billy Joe is the guy that became super famous. And I mean, I'm not a Green Day hater. Green Day is good, but there's definitely bands from that crew that are better than Green Day.
I mean, there might be a little bit of jealousy about that. They, you know, they happen to be the ones that hit it big out of all of them at the time. But I mean, honestly, out of any of those bands, you know, not a lot of them can throw stones because they've all been down that road of doing shit for money. Except for maybe NoFX.
Yeah, honestly, that's a good point. You know, like I said, I'm not a huge I don't mean to keep downplaying the band. I'm not a mega fan, but I think they're fine. NoFX never sold out. You know what I mean? Like, never.
Because the rest of them all had their moments, right? Like Rancid, you know, whatever, they ended up on that major. They had those few years where they were, you know, really publicly, you know, doing really crappy press where they were hanging out with the Osborne family or hanging out with Pink or whatever, right? And they were doing all that stuff.
Getting pictures from Madonna.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, exactly. So they went through that phase. You know, Bad Religion was on their major for a while. There's not a lot of bands from that. I mean, not that Bad Religion is necessarily exactly the same generation as those. But, you know, NoFX, to their credit, maybe it's just because, you know, they had big labels like Fat and Epitaph to fall back on, but whatever. They never went, you know, as far down that hole as any of them else. So of any of them, to me, NoFX is the most street cred.
I agree.
But also, you say big labels like Fat and Epitaph, but when we're talking 20 years ago, those were not big labels. I mean, those were things that those are labels that were operating out of people's garages and sheds and stuff like that. I mean, we think about them being big labels because of what they've turned into now, legacy they've had.
But you can't divorce the fact that, you know, Fat hugely benefited from being on Epitaph after the Offspring smash broke, where all of a sudden Epitaph is flush with cash. So, like, they're not completely divorced from, you know, from what's going on necessarily in the major label world as much as I'd like to think. But
sure, good point.
But that said, you know, at least on paper, they didn't go as far as the rest of them. So,
but also, I don't know
where I'm going. I'm talking in circles, but yeah.
Also, I'm curious, and I saw this in the comments when the story first went up. How likely do you think it is that Fat Mike would have done this had the other punk rock musical not been done previously?
Good question.
We're talking about it now.
I'd say likely, maybe slightly less likely because it wouldn't be in the back of his mind. But like I said, Fat Mike it really is musically adventurous. I don't think he gets quite enough credit for being as musically adventurous as he is. Like, there's that one song, which I think is a beautiful song, My Orphan Year, where he sings about how both his parents died in like a year or something like that.
Exactly.
And it's not a punk rock. I mean, honestly, it's essentially, it's Cats in the Cradle. What the hell is that? James Taylor type song. You know what I mean?
Harry Chapin. Yeah.
I'm not doing so hot tonight. But then, you know, they also got the decline and stuff. So I think Matt Fike, I think Fat Mike is up to do daring things and interesting things. And I think maybe he doesn't give a whole lot of thought to things before he does them. And kudos to him for that, because by acting on impulse, you don't have a thing telling you can't do it. And so sometimes when you just do it, you just do it. So I think he'd be likely to do it. Maybe ever so less likely, but I mean, I think it probably would have existed either way. And let's wrap up this podcast.
You got a song? You got any music?
I think Mark Little's got a tune for us.
Yeah, actually, I do. I've got a song from a band that I got into kind of late in the year, but it's one of my favorite records of the year. It's a band from Atlanta called The Coat Hangers. It was a 4-piece band, and then their keyboard player dropped out of the band a couple of years ago, and now it's a trio. All of them coincidentally have the same last name as Coat Hanger. But this is
what
a record.
What a coincidence! Like, wow!
I know, it's shocking. It's absolutely shocking. And this is a record that I've absolutely fallen in love with. And the video for this song, they have another very, 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 how do you say it, very little known band from Atlanta also playing a part in the video called Mastodon. I'm sure nobody else has heard of them. But this is a song called Follow Me by the Coat Hangers.
He's bringing us the jams, bringing us the bebops, the tree bops, and the slamming beats. So let's wrap up tonight's podcast. Mark Will, thanks for bringing the kicking tunes. Thanks for bringing the tattoo insight. Thanks for bringing some of that Florida heat to the Ice Cold Punk News podcast.
Thank you very much.
And Adam White, a man always of deep insight. Thanks for letting us see the inside of your brain via your brand new tattoo. So thank you for opening yourself for us so that we may better understand this enigma that is Adam White.
I'll just get a new one every week and we'll talk about it.
Awesome.
Fantastic. Well, thanks again for listening. You can reach us at podcast@punknews.org, and we'll see you next week.